Okay. Pleasure to be here. It's great to see this collection of people who have an interest in modeling short pulse propagation. And the context in which I want to talk about it is in terms of lasers, Modlock lasers, which are sort of very common now in the commercial market. These are lasers that are produced routinely now hundreds of femtosecond pulses. You can get this for about $30,000. You can buy one, put it on your desk somewhere if you'd like. But more and more they're pushing towards the ultra-fast science angle of trying to get shorter and shorter pulses, higher and higher performance for various reasons. And so I'm going to talk about some of the modeling issues going on there. And before I start, I thought I'd at least acknowledge some of the collaborators that I work with. On the experimental side, I work with Frank Wise at Cornell, Steve Cundiff at Gila in Colorado, and they build these lasers and have had long-standing collaborations with them, as well as a number of people here that have been doing theory with for quite some time. I think everybody knows Bjorn. He lives around some of you. So, Alex Wei, Hong Kong. And then the second half of this work, a lot of it's going to be with Ted Farnham. And this is going to be related to the short pulse work that we're doing in the context of mode locking. And also, let me just, this is sort of the group I work with at University of Washington. I have a collection of grad students, a postdoc, and two of them are here, Matt Williams and Edwin Ding, and they are also working in this laser area. They're giving talks tomorrow afternoon, and I'll tell you a little bit about some of the things they're going to do here, but they have interesting stories of their own to work with. Okay, and by the way, there is a fountain there with water, and nowadays we just get water all the time. This has been one of the worst winters we've had. In fact, I was hoping when we flew to Toronto, we'd at least get away from rain. And I got, you know, more rain. I would like to see sun somewhere this year. Yes. Yeah. I have a young Chris Jones on there, exactly. I like to say Chris Jones is my PhD student. So let's talk a little bit about propagation. But also laser science in general and sort of where the idea of mode locking is coming from, which is if you go back historically quite a ways, back into the early 20s, there was a prediction made by Bose. He wrote a paper in which he had done some work where he basically predicted that you could get this condensed state of photons, so all these photons in the same quantum mechanical state. He wrote this up. He submitted it for publication. It got roundly rejected over and over in the British journals. But he did send it to someone who read it and saw its value. Here he is. Now, the way I heard the story originally was Einstein liked the paper so much, he pushed for the paper to get through. And it's not actually how it happened. He liked the paper so much, he sat on it for 2 years. Till he worked out the condensed state for matter, and then once he got those calculations all worked out, then he pushed for the Bose paper to get through. And so they both came out, so you have this prediction of a condensed state of photons or matter that come naturally from quantum mechanics. Okay, so that's in the early 1920s or so, to the mid-1920s. And it's quite a while between this time frame to 1950s and early 60s where you have the development of the first laser, which really is a realization of this first prediction by Bose, which is in 1953 the first microwave amplifier was built, and here it is. This is a very young Charles Townes at Columbia University, and this is Jim Gordon, who was a longtime member of Bell Labs, both giants of the field, fantastic scientists, and he was a grad student at this point. I think this is actually in the Smithsonian at this point. This is the first maser, 1953. First author is Jim Gordon. Charles Townes gets the Nobel. So the point is, you know, you want to be not the grad student when these papers come out. But they went on to very promising careers, both of them. You are very young. And 1953, and it's another 7 years or so where you take this idea of amplifying electromagnetic energy, and you put two mirrors and make a cavity, and you have your first laser. And that was Ted Maimon. He built the first Ruby laser at Hughes Research Labs in California. In fact, we just this past year celebrated the 50th anniversary of the laser. Okay, so now we're in year 51. So that is that's that prediction in 1924, finally realized in 1960, this condensed state of photons, all these photons in the same quantum mechanical state, so you have this highly coherent source of light, the laser light. And if you look, the extension by Einstein of a condensed state of matter actually came much later than that, in 1995, when you had the first Bose-Einstein condensates. And this is 71 years after the initial prediction, and part of the reason for this is to get into the regime where you could actually condense matter and get them all in the same quantum mechanical state required you to be down sort of in the micro to nano Kelvin. There was two Nobel Prizes rewarded for cooling of atoms down to that level. So just the technology to get you into that regime was remarkable. And then finally, 1995, two groups, Ketterle's at MIT, which is a multi-million dollar lab setup, and then the group at Gila, Cornell and Wyman, who built it on a shoestring budget, and they kind of got it first. So you got to like that. They were kind of being like MacGyver. They just put it together. It worked. They beat the more expensive group by a little bit, like a half a year or something like this. Okay, so that's the idea. That's what we want to look at, this condensed state of photons. And I'm going to put this chart up here because I would argue this is the reason we're here. If you look at this chart, this actually comes from an article by Hermann Hauss, who is one of the giants of mode locking, both in theory, experiments coming out of his group at MIT. And this was an article he wrote for a millennial issue in a journal of quantum electronics. And there they were talking about the future directions of all these fields in quantum electronics. And he wrote the one on mode locking. And he put this chart up. And you start from 1965. And this is in 2000. So right here, you know, they have results up to 1995, or TISAF, which is basically the workhorse of ultra-fast science. You can buy one of these for about $150,000. They're kind of big, but they're in labs all over the country, all over the world. Now, the Thai Sapphire laser is the workhorse, ultra-fast science. Can produce very short pulses, very dependably. It's a solid-state laser. And what you see here is from the first pulse lasers, and you can see the dropping of the pulse width in time. So now you're getting down here all the way down into the hundreds of femtoseconds. And now, routinely, I mean, this is a little bit old, now routinely people can just, there's many labs that produce, you know, 5 femtosecond, 6 femtosecond pulses, and even some recent experiments that are producing sub-femtosecond pulses. Now, they don't actually measure these sub-femtosecond pulses. What they look at is proxies, which tell them that there must have been one of these ultra-fast pulses in there. This is otherwise, I would have not seen some kind of radiation come out of some atoms, atomic radiation. So in fact, down here, you have groups like Ursula Keller's at ETH Zurich. This is also where you're starting to observe atomic transitions. You can actually watch atoms dissociate in real time. So before, it was just, here they are before, here they are after. And now you can watch the whole process happen in sort of real time, because now you have such a fast source of light. It's like having a strobe light where you can take a picture. The snapshot's now happening on sub-femtosecond timescales. So it's really impressive what's going on here. But it also suggests that we might need to start thinking about getting serious about how we want to model down here, right? So we've already had some very nice talks about nonlinear Schrodinger, short pulse, and one of the things I want to talk about is those models in the context of this figure here, which is as we start pushing down here, you know, I can tell you about the theory I've got going on here, and I want to tell you about what you got to do to get down here and to try to get accurate results. Okay, oop. Yeah, okay. So a couple things we need to think about, by the way. Chromatic dispersion, self-phase modulation. This is just coming up from your Kerr nonlinearity. In a laser cavity, here are the two things that we're going to add to it. So for instance, we've already had talks on propagation, two very nice talks this morning on doing short pulse. And one of the things that you typically think about is, how do I handle these things? And now I'm going to say, well, look, in a laser cavity, what I have is I have attenuation, and I have to inject gain into the cavity, put mirrors in there, and see what kind of forms. And what I'm trying to do is, instead of launching pulses that are pre-prepared, I'm just going to turn my laser on, and from just white noise, electromagnetic radiation, I want this thing to self-organize into pulses. And I'm going to give you a little cartoon of what this looks like. And here is what we're going to do. Here's my laser cavity. It's going to be a ring laser. And what I'm going to do is, this little green ball, I'm going to sort of, in some sense, in these pictures here, show you the spectrum of what's in that green ball. So I'm going to follow the pulse around, or the energy around in the cavity. And what you're going to see is, the idea of mode locking is, as I propagate in this cavity under some physical effects, and every time I go through here, this is an output coupler, I start shedding off whatever's in the cavity, I start spitting it out down, let's say, a fiber line. And what I can watch here is the evolution of the spectrum for at each individual round trip, and then the spectrum of this whole cavity train. And notice that I start off with white noise, and it's got some stuff, and then it starts to form these localized solutions directly. So in some sense, this is what we're interested in. We're interested in these localized solutions. Often we might say that's the soliton-like solution we're interested in. But notice that this thing forms passively, and it almost seems to be a global attractor to the system. I just turn it on from any white noise initial conditions. This is what appears. And this is what they like this for, right? The guys who build mode-lock lasers, they put this thing on, they turn it on, this is what they want out. In a millisecond, they got this beautiful stream. They can run these mode-lock lasers for weeks, and it'll produce this for weeks. Just steady output of light, very high intensity, very short width. And now you can start doing things with it. Probing material, and doing spectroscopy, whatever you want to do with that laser light. Okay? So this is what we want to try to model here. And this is the kind of thing that we're looking at. And then if you look at this width here, you could say, well, okay, so my commercial laser will produce something for me that is hundreds of femtoseconds, but ultimately there's a push to say, well, how about if I make one that produces something that's 3 to 5 femtoseconds? Okay, and how do I think about trying to model that? Okay, so let's try to build a theoretical framework to understand this. And many of you will be very familiar with a lot of what I'll present, but hopefully there'll be some new twists that will at least intrigue you in some sense. Okay, so we're going to start off with two different models. We're going to start off with just a qualitative way to think about it. Then we'll get into some quantitative models, and then we'll move into a short pulse framework. So I'm going to present first sort of the dogmatic view, the dogmatic theoretical view of how to model mode-lock lasers. So you'll find these in the textbooks or the theoretical developments of mode-lock lasers. And it all starts with something we're very familiar with, the nonlinear Schrodinger, right? You say, okay, so what's been going on for a long time is that, dating all the way back to 1973, where Hasegawa said, hey, look at this. The glass that is propagating through in fiber, for instance, has this cubic response to the intensity. So I can do a center frequency expansion, right, which has already been outlined this morning. And what I can do is show that, in fact, if I do a center frequency expansion, the envelope of the electric field is governed by the nonlinear Schrodinger equation. There it is. Okay? So by the way, in 72, right, you had the Zakharov-Shabbat eigenvalue problem that was laid out, soliton solutions there. 73, Hasegawa-Tappert proposed this for fibers. And then Lynn Mollenauer in 1980 actually demonstrated these optical solitons in fibers. Okay? Why did it take 7 years? Well, it turns out glass was not manufactured very well until about there's a lot of technology that they needed to actually manufacture glass to be so transparent that the losses were not so bad that you could actually propagate these things for a distance and observe the solitons. Before that, it was so lossy that things would just get destroyed very quickly before they'd propagate very far. Okay, and it just everything's based upon this simple relation that the index of refraction is some constant and it has some intensity-dependent part. Okay, by the way, I don't know if anybody can comment on this. The earliest I can find a reference to something like Nonlinear Schrödinger is some Gross Pdfsky work in the 1950s. And so there's this Russian literature that you can follow back so far, and then you lose the trail around 1950s, or at least I did, because I couldn't find anything before that. So that's my earliest reference of Nonlinear Schrödinger is sort of in the context of Gross Pdfsky. See that's what I was trying to find a reference, and if I could get it from you, that'd be great. So I can say, here's the first time we see NLS somewhere in literature, right? That's what I would like to do. Okay, so that's the framework of what we normally think about, and it makes sense for the most part for what people were looking at the early days of the laser, because you know they were looking at picoseconds, 100 femtoseconds, nothing too short. Certainly in the 90s, it wasn't that short. So they said, okay, NLS is a perfectly valid description. And what Herman House did, and here he is there. He had sort of the MIT mafia on laser work for a while there. As he said, tell you what, I know how everything is governed in the fiber. It's nonlinear Schrödinger. Now what I know, there's some other things in the cavity that happen. First, I have losses. Then I have some gain. And it's bandwidth limited. So I'm going to amplify a certain set of frequencies, and let me just say that there's some center frequencies and it falls off parabolically from that center frequency. So that's what that simple model comes in there. So I have my gain, my loss. And then he said, in the cavity, for mode locking to happen, and in other words, if I'm just going to throw noise into this thing and have this thing self-form into a pulse, I need something that's going to do intensity discrimination, something that's going to favor high intensities over low intensities. Okay? I want low intensities to disappear, high intensities to get amplified more so. So he said, that's what my cavity is doing, and what I'm going to do is just write down a qualitative, simplest qualitative model possible to describe that. I'll just put cubic gain in. Cubic gain. Simple as that. Higher intensities, get more amplification. Okay. So that is what was called the master mode locking equation of House. Now, one feature here I want to talk about real quick, just highlight for you, is you see this gain term? It is dependent upon the propagation distance. And here is the formula that comes from the rate equations, which is it basically says it's some constant over 1 plus equals the L2 norm, which is the cavity energy, over some saturation energy in the cavity. So this is a very important term, because what it does is it says, look, if my gain starts to get really big and I start to get a lot of cavity energy, essentially I've depleted all the carriers giving me the gain. So my gain should go down. So if my L2 norm grows very large, this G of Z starts going to zero. However, if I have hardly any energy in the cavity, that means my carrier is in the inverted state, I'm ready to give a maximum amount of energy. And what's that maximum amount of energy? Well, if that's zero, my maximum amount is 2 G-naught. So as long as 2 G-naught is bigger than my losses, I have a net gain. Things start to grow in the cavity. But if I get a lot, it saturates. It's a saturable gain media. It's critical for understanding stability. Just assuming this to be constant gives you very different stability properties. In fact, if you assume that to be constant, localized solutions to this are always unstable. That's something that Todd Capitula proved. Okay? But with this here, pushes the eigenvalues back into the left half plane. Okay, so this is the model that he wrote down. It's heuristic, but it works really nicely in terms of capturing some of the basic behavior. And here's like a simulation of this. You start with some pulse, it goes on to this attracting set. By the way, here is the solution to the Ginzburg-Landau equation. Okay. So one's the gain. So this is the gain, but this is a diffusion term, which is a loss. In other words, you get gain at certain frequencies, and as you go away from that, you basically have no gain on the outskirts, right? So you only get, right? Yep. Mm-hmm. Okay. So that is, in fact, Herman House, his stature and reputation in the community. He was sort of the leading figure, both in theory, and his group was one of the leading experimental groups. If you look at all these amazing people who were building Mohnlach lasers in the 90s, almost everybody came out of that group. Really an impressive array of people. And so there was sort of this dogmatic belief. This is how you think about Mohnlach lasers. Fair enough. It's a nice model, but the only thing I would say about it is that it's qualitative. And maybe if you want to do something quantitative, you need to do something else. So let's start thinking about how to think about quantitative models. And I'm going to highlight for you a few quantitative models just to kind of give you an idea that you can get other kind of governing equations out of this that really still capture all the fundamental things that this does. So let's start off with this here, which is, this is probably one of the most common lasers on the market. You can buy it for about $20,000. And what it is just a ring laser with a polarizer. And here's how it works. With high intensities, when you go around this cavity, you're going to put a polarizer here. What ends up happening, the fiber itself has an elliptical shape, which causes a rotation of the polarization state. And in fact, with intensity, it creates a polarization wobble. So think of the polarization of the electric field doing this as a function of intensity. So low intensities, very slow wobble. High intensities, very fast. So you can always ask, I'm going to turn this laser cavity on, what's going to survive? Because I'm going to now put this polarizer here, and as my light goes around once, suppose it's a meter-long cavity, that polarizer kills everything that's not in alignment with it. So there's only one polarization rotation wobble rate that actually in 1 meter comes back. Does that make sense? That is the intensity that gets selected by this laser, the one that has that one rotation rate. Now, you could always say, well, what about the one that has twice it or three times? Turns out these are higher energy or energetically less favorable states. In fact, they exist in the cavity, but when you turn it on from noise, it goes to the state which is most energetically favorable, which is the single wobble per round trip. That's how it selects. That's how it does the mode locking. You start with noise. You start amplifying, and it just says, okay, I'm going to pick the one out that does this, and it forms a pulse around that rotation rate. Okay? So it's self-starting. It's very nice. Now let me give you a different way to mode lock a cavity. Suppose I take, again, a ring cavity, but now I put on there what's called a parametric amplifier or phase-sensitive amplifier, and here's what it does. It amplifies according to phase. If a pulse is in phase with this amplifier, it gets amplified. If it's out of phase, it gets attenuated. That's how this thing works. So it's going to work on the same concept of the polarizer. You're going to go around here, and I want to try to sort of give you the intuition of how this works just by simply thinking about the one soliton solution of NLS. You know, you're going around this fiber. It's like NLS-like. And if I look at the one soliton solution there, you have this parameter eta, right? It's a one family parameter describing this thing. But I want you to notice one thing. It has amplitude width, and what's its phase rotation doing? It goes like eta squared. Okay, so in other words, the phase rotation depends upon the amplitude. So it's going to start rotating at a certain rate. What rate? Well, higher amplitudes rotate faster, low amplitudes rotate slower. And just like the polarizer, once per round trip, it has to be aligned with the phase of that amplifier. So if that's 1 meter, after 1 meter, it has to do one phase rotation. One phase rotation. That's the only amplitude that survives. If you have higher amplitude, it gets killed off. Lower amplitude gets killed off and gets shifted over. Okay? So that's how this works. Same concept as the previous one, but instead of working with polarization, it's working with phase. Final example. These waveguide arrays. Waveguide arrays are basically a set of parallel waveguides. And if I inject light into the zeroth waveguide, and this is at low intensity, what ends up happening, waveguides talk to each other through evanescent coupling. So energy gets shifted to neighboring waveguides, and you get this discrete diffraction pattern that happens. Okay? Now, at high power, nonlinearity starts to play a role, and essentially, the nonlinearity causes a self-focusing which prevents the coupling of energy to the neighboring waveguides. Okay? So low power, discretely diffracted, high power just goes, it stays in that center waveguide. Now how can you use this to make a mode lock laser? Well, now think about putting this in a cavity. So what I'm going to do now is wrap fiber around here. It comes into zero, and I pull it out at zero. And this is all CW light. So now what I'm going to do, suppose I put a pulse in there. The front and the back of the pulse are low amplitude. The front and the back of the pulse do this. The front and the back of the pulse, most of their energy goes to the neighboring waveguides and are thrown away. The peak of the pulse, or the center of this pulse, does more like this. It takes very little loss. So the idea is now, as you send a pulse through, what this waveguide array does is it shaves off the front and the back. And here it is, the input-output relationship. So you see, you shave this off and you start to create the narrowing that you need, the pulse formation that you need. Oh, by the way, what stops this narrowing? What stops this narrowing is the fact that as it starts to get very short in the time domain, it gets very broad in the frequency domain, and you remember, you have a bandwidth-limited gain. So once it gets up against the parabolic gain profile, it can't keep spreading. There's no gain out there. It just dies. So there's this balance that happens now between the gain-loss dynamics and this here. Okay, so let me just show you, by the way, here's a movie, and here is low energy pulse propagating through waveguide array, high energy pulse. And you can see the low energy just starts to shed all its energy out to the neighboring waveguides, the high energy pulse propagates it through cleanly. And in here, this is going to be a movie, the whole waveguide mode locking. I'm going to follow this ball around. I'm going to go around in the fiber through the waveguide array. And by the way, the dynamics in the waveguide array is going to be illustrated right here. Here's waveguide 0 to waveguide 10 to minus 10. As I propagate through, you'll see what happens here. And here is what's happening actually in the cavity itself. So let's try to watch this as it goes. So I'm propagating around. I start off with white noise. Still kind of looks like a mess. But notice what happens over multiple round trips. This waveguide array, round trip after round trip, keeps working away at the pulse energy, keeps shaping it. Now notice what happens. Now notice what you're starting to see inside the fiber. Beautiful mode lock pulse just generated spontaneously from the noise. And when you're in the waveguide array, you actually get this X wave structure. And here is, after every round trip, you can just keep track of what happens. And you notice I started with noise, and this is the mode locking process. Very clean. You basically use the waveguide array to create a global attractor for yourself inside of the system, and everything just gets sucked right into that. There it is. Okay, and we also have this X-wave structure, which has some interesting properties in itself. Okay, now here's kind of the point of this, and partly where maybe you start thinking about future directions, which is if you look at all those systems, they're really doing all the same thing. They're all saying, start with noise, generate for me this beautiful localized pulse. Now, but let me show you mathematically that each one of them is quite different. In the first case, in these three different cases, here's the waveguide array model. The waveguide array model, turns out there's NLS, here's your loss, your gain, but now everything's dominated by coupling to the nearest waveguide. So you put a coupling, linear coupling. It's not even a nonlinear gain anymore, right? It's a linear coupling to the neighboring waveguide, which then couples to its neighboring waveguide. And it turns out you can reproduce all the dynamics. You need 3 waveguides to do it. Okay? If you do 20, it's the same as 3. We're not completely clear on all the reasons for that. But it turns out that's one model for a mode lock laser, which is very different than the cubic quintet Ginsburg-Landau. And by the way, the derivation of this, Edwin will be talking about this tomorrow. you know, you're using a Taylor expansion to handle what happens inside of the cavity when it starts doing the intensity discrimination. I always tell my undergraduate students, the most important skill you have is Taylor expanding. They never believe this, but you tell it to them over and over again, they don't quite get it. It's like, just if you know how to Taylor expand, you're going to get far in life. Look at us. Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. But you can even do better than that, and it's kind of nice. The Taylor expansion actually introduces some interesting issues that I won't talk about, but here's a Ginsburg-Landau model, which is very different than this. And in the phase-sensitive amplifier case, where you're actually locking the phase to that amplifier, you get a Swift-Holmberg-type model. And the point of all this is that this phenomena isn't just packaged as NLS. This phenomena is packaged as Swift-Holmberg or Ginsburg-Landau or this waveguide array. So those different models can start describing all the key features of these laser cavities. Okay. All right. But now, let's go to the real point here, which is, that's all fine and good. We're, hundreds of femtoseconds, and, NLS actually works remarkably well, even when it shouldn't. But still, as we start getting down to a couple cycles of electric field, it'd be really nice to have a more accurate model down there. So we're going to start thinking about going beyond the center frequency expansion. So I won't say much, except for here's your picture. We've already seen it today, right? So normally you would do an NLS derivation. It's a slowly varying envelope of a high frequency oscillation, right? But then you start saying, well, yeah, but if I'm going to get down into this few femtosecond regime, I'm going to be more like this. My oscillation electric field is on the order of my envelope. It doesn't even make sense anymore to start thinking about an asymptotic separation. And so you have a number of papers here looking at this and how to describe this here. And in fact, I would say that Gene and Tobias were a little ahead of their time, because in some sense, 2004, when this comes out, people start talking about out-of-second physics, like in Nature photonics. All of a sudden you say, towards out-of-second physics. That was 2008, 2009. So it's ahead of the curve, but now everybody's like, okay, we got to take this seriously, because we are starting to get down there. And so I think this is a great paper setting sort of that goal of thinking forward that way. Okay, so, and again, I'm going to present some stuff right out of your guys' paper, which is, if you look at glass and you look at its behavior over a very broad range of frequency space, you can approximate this whole thing by something that's quadratic in the frequency domain, and I think that's the biggest point. Where people really want to work is something that maybe has 1,000 to 2,000 nanometers max bandwidth. And you know what? You can do really well across 3,000 nanometers with a simple polynomial quadratic in the frequency. And so it's like, well, great, you should use it. And if you do it, you get a better fitting result. Here's your multiple scale approach, right? And you even can write down your short pulse equation, have these beautiful solutions. Yeah, we like those. Everybody loves an exact solution to work with, and these are very nice. And so we can start looking at this solution set that comes out of the second. I think that's the first place there, right, in your paper? That's one, right? Okay. It's all parameterized by this parameter m, right? And as m gets towards sine pi over 8, then you start seeing this thing getting down, way down to where you want it. And if m is a little bit larger, then it's more NLS-ish. Okay. So this is only a starter, right? Because for me, I'm thinking about that as my NLS, where I'm going to add up all these other terms onto it. I don't really care. I mean, I do care. But ultimately, what I want to do now is say, all I've got is the dispersive terms. I need to now add my loss, gain, bandwidth limitations, all these things. And I want to make attractors. This is a great solution, but I want to make this solution the global attractor, okay, of my dynamics. So how do I do that? So one way to do this is just think about what House did. House just said, okay, you want to make this thing into a laser. So let's go ahead and take So here's his master Malachi equation again. Let's recall what he did. He just said, look, I have NLS. I'm going to add bandwidth limited gain, loss, and a cubic gain. And those three ingredients are enough to make these such solutions be attractors. Let's do the same thing for the short pulse. Take your short pulse. Add some gain with some bandwidth, some loss, some cubic gain. What kind of bandwidth should we put in here? Now, since we're not doing center frequency where we just put in a second, you know, a diffusive term to model a parabolic gain profile, we put in something like this, a cube, quadratic quartic type term, derivative. So it models two gain windows, bandwidth, right? Negative omega and plus omega. And what we're going to do is say, okay, this is going to be the short pulse master Malachi equation. So I've got my short pulse dynamics, and now what I have in here is all the corresponding terms, and just like Hals, I built a qualitative model for what that should look like. And I can adjust tau 2 and tau 4. What do these do? Tau 2 and tau 4 adjust my gain bandwidth, and it turns out that's really quite important. Adjusting your gain bandwidth, making it broader, is going to give you shorter pulses. If you want to make 5 femtosecond pulses, you've got to amplify hundreds of nanometers of bandwidth. Okay? So that's what you've got to do to make this thing work. All right, so let me just show you some dynamics of this real quick. Let's take this thing here, and let's assume a form of this P of K, which is this or this. All I'm doing is changing the tau 2, tau 4 parameters. And in this case here, I can start with noise, and I can get this thing, as I look at this thing in time, this is time 0 all the way to time 670, this thing basically starts off with noise, evolves to here, which has, you know, quite a number of cycles, 5, 6, not that many. Or here, I make it a little bit broader, bit gain bandwidth, start with noise, evolves down to this two-cycle mode lock pulse. So this is like the solution, these special solutions, but now I've created them as attractors. I just start off with anything, and this is a global attractor. It just wants to go right onto that thing. Okay. And, you know, these are two different cases. As you change this parameter M and from 0.1 to 0.35, you can see that what you get is broader gain bandwidth, and you get shorter pulses in this range. Now, one of the things that happens in this laser model that's common to all these laser models, which is very important that it actually replicates this, which is ultimately what people want is they want to crank energy into this cavity, and what they want is one giant pulse of energy. Okay, so just keep turning in the gain. What happens instead of just getting one giant pulse, it splits into two. You add more energy, splits into three, splits into four. It's the multipulsing instability. And it's a little frustrating because ultimately what it does is it limits the amount of energy you can deliver per pulse. This thing will break apart. And here it is, as you turn up the gain, it goes from one pulse to two to three. It's the multipulsing instability. You see it in the master mode locking equation or Ginzburg-Landau type descriptions. You also see it here in the short pulse framework. There's a certain amount of energy it wants to have. And partly it's just think of it this way. If you keep turning up the gain in the cavity, it will make a more intense, shorter pulse, broader gain bandwidth. But once it starts hitting the gain bandwidth window, it is more energetically favorable for it to split into two pulses with less energy and a little bit broader so that they live underneath gain bandwidth than one big pulse that's trying to get outside of the gain bandwidth. Okay, the gain bandwidth is just imposing itself there. And that's what ultimately limits this. You can't get beyond it. And this is just, again, going up from the one branch, two, three, and so forth. Okay. So we've got this. Let me just do one more thing here, which is this model was trying to replicate essentially what Hals had done, which is to say, let me make a qualitative model about short pulse mode locking. So now let's do something else, which is to say, I want to do something more quantitative and maybe try to track it to an experiment. So in other words, instead of just putting in some cubic gain, which I don't even know how I'd fit that parameter to the experiment, let me actually try to model something where all the parameters I can know ahead of time. And here is what I want to model. Mirrors, a waveguide array. Now, what we saw in the waveguide array is fantastic because it does all this pulse shaping for us. But now I'm going to amplify not with glass, which has normally a bandwidth of about 30 nanometers. I'm going to amplify with the Thai sapphire crystal. By the way, Thai sapphire, I said, is the workhorse of ultrafast science, partly because they can engineer this to give you hundreds of nanometers of gain, of bandwidth in the gain. So in other words, you use this instead, and already you're amplifying this much frequency versus if you use fiber, you're amplifying this much part of the spectrum. Okay? So it means you're going to be able to push the pulses shorter. So this is what basically Kartner, Ippen group at MIT are using and pushing their results with. They're generating, you know, 3 to 5 femtosecond pulses, and they're engineering this cavity. They don't have a waveguide array. They put a quantum well saturated absorber, but we're going to put a waveguide array in there. I propose that as an idea. And I just want to show you that you can get another model for this. In other words, the NLS still, or the SPE is still there, but now you have very different kinds of things you build around the SPE, not just the Ginsburg-Landau type description. Here, you've got your loss, you got your gain, bandwidth limited gain, you have your loss, but now you get coupling to the nearest waveguide, which then couples to the nearest waveguide. So now you get coupled short pulse equations, which reproduce mode locking. And let me show you some of the results of this. Here they are. You do this, and these are the final steady state solutions. This is the evolution in the center waveguide and the two nearest waveguides. Notice that the energy is quite a bit lower in the neighboring waveguide. You're shedding part of it out. And so what we did is ignored the nonlinearity in the neighboring waveguides. The nonlinearity dominates here. It's not so much over here. Look at that. That one's over here, 10 to minus 4. And this is if you center it in a frame of reference with the pulse, you can see that the phase is still evolving under there. Here is just showing you as you change your gain bandwidth, you can go from something like this to here, get shorter and shorter pulses just by broadening your gain bandwidth, and this is why it's so important to work with the Thai sapphire type laser crystal, because you need to amplify a very broad range. And again, these are global, what appear to be global attractors. And then we consider still the multipulsing instability as well. You start with one pulse, increase the gain. This is a little interesting. You see the pulse still there, and now you see this dispersive radiation pedestal that doesn't quite know what to do yet. Doesn't have enough energy to form a pulse, but doesn't want to go away either. So it just sits there as a pedestal. You go up a little bit more on the gain. Now the thing has enough energy to sort of form a second pulse structure. And here is the 2 to 3, as you just, again, keep going up on the energy. And this is, I'll just highlight that. This paper will appear later this year for the waveguide array. Now, let me mention a couple shortcomings, and I think this is where I think some very interesting work could come up. And I'm sure a lot of people here in the room are aware of this, right? Which is, yes, let's just take the simplest case, Maxwell's 1D. And normally, and here's what's interesting, right? With what you did actually in the short pulse is you handled this thing here beautifully. Like, you took care of that. You said over 3,000 nanometers. Look at this. I could just do the whole thing out clean. Piece of cake. It's beautiful. Taking care of the linear dispersive terms very nicely. However, you just said, let's let the nonlinearity be instantaneous. Okay, now this is where it gets a little tricky. And I'm not saying tricky for me, because I like this equation. So I'm on our side. But from the other side, from the optics people, they'd say, like, wait a minute. You did all this work to get down to this femtosecond regime and took care of all this, and you said that was instantaneous? This is where they don't buy it. Partly, they have a point. And in fact, you'd have to argue with someone like John Dudley, who's pushing supercontinuum generation, who would say, look, if you want to start modeling, take a 200 femtosecond laser output, throw it into a photonic crystal fiber, and compress the hell out of it, so all of a sudden it comes out and it's producing ultra-short pulses, he would say, this is what you do. You just keep taking tailor expanding your dispersive terms, you know, keep 10, 20 terms, whatever. You can measure this across glass, and you just keep more and more and more terms. You got a ton of numerical stiffness, but who cares? Computers are cheap, and that's a danger. because you can just then do it. And then he says, well, and then you also need the Raman response. And I need to count for all this. So if you look at his paper, he would say, this here is sufficient. We don't need to go to your approach of super pulse, short pulse. Why? Just use this. Just keep more terms. And I'd say, okay, so, and by the way, it's a fair criticism. Because one of the things that they'll do is they say, I have experiments and I have these simulations running, and why should I change formulation? We feel comfortable within the framework of NLS. It's sort of a dogmatic thing. People have a certain intuition for how that works. So what I'd argue for is that if we were to do the same thing for short pulse and just say, okay, let's keep the time response of this nonlinearity, the Raman response, not do any expansions, even get the wave-breaking terms, just say, conclude the whole thing, the whole R, this is the short pulse evolution, which accounts for 3,000 nanometers of bandwidth plus the response of the nonlinear material. And here, this R is experimentally measured. So this is actually, this is where you start to get them to start buying it, because you've included within this model all the same terms they included in theirs. And if you ask me, this is a lot cleaner. And you can actually put in the full Raman response, just like they do. So now you start. Now you're starting play as. Now you can start playing as equals. Use these approximations. I use the same ones. We can go head to head on these. And I think that's the right potential framework to be working in. Is this one here? Okay. Final comment, which is, it would be also nice to include somehow how the Chi-3 varies as a function of frequency. I'll give you three references. The most recent here, 2010. So it's pretty reasonable. Pretty recent, I mean. And here is the quote. It is concluded that currently available data insufficient and should be augmented to provide better guidance for experimental work. As a result, very little can be said about Chi-3 as a function of omega. They just don't have it. They have Chi-3 at 1.55 microns. Yeah, what about 1 micron? I mean, if you're going to do 1,000 nanometers, you need Chi-3 across a huge range of values. They have 2. So, for instance, in what Tobias and Gene did, they said, I have the whole thing over 3,500 nanometers, so I can do a little fit. Here you got 1 point. So, it's okay. And the way it gets us off the hook at first, because it's like, if you don't know it, I'm just going to assume it's constant. So it gives you one less mathematical difficulty to worry about. So maybe you can concentrate on the time response instead, but eventually it'd be nice to also think about how you would incorporate the frequency dependence, because the frequency dependence is what gives us this extra linear term. And you ask, what would it give me in the nonlinear case? Okay, so that's pretty much it. I would just say we need theory beyond center frequency. And this nonlinearity still needs more advanced treatment. But I think it's promising, and again, in the Moonlock laser context, it's not just promising, it's completely relevant to what they're doing today. It is clear that if you're going to start modeling down at 3 to 5 femtoseconds, and they're, by the way, 3 to 5 femtoseconds, they're trying to blow past that and try to get to 1 in sub-femtosecond. I think the shortest is 650 attoseconds, right? So as soon as you go above a femtosecond, then you call attosecond science and you get Nature paper, right? I mean, you put the atto in there and they love that, okay? Even though you did that much better. But the point is, down there, I think you really need something better than NLS is going to hold. So that's all I got to say. Thanks.